This is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Unless, of course, you have wisdom, in which case you don't need any more information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
Doing good. We got Frank Hugenard on the show tonight. And
yes, we do.
If you could give me a brief bio on him, that would be awesome.
Well, Frank has received his Bachelor of Science in Computer Science from Purdue University in 1982, and he has spent decades in the Silicon Valley as a software engineer. About 10 years ago, he was escorted out the door of the company he was working for by an armed guard when he was fired for inventing a product that not only contained most of the functionality of Skype, but which had features Skype still doesn't have. All this happened while his best friend and soulmate was losing her battle with breast cancer. Several years later, Skype was purchased for $3 billion by eBay, and Frank was still unemployed and broke. In a quest to make sense of his bewilderment, he set out on a spiritual journey to understand the nature of his reality. The end result of this search has been his desire to share with the world his own newfound happiness and how he went about in achieving it. Apart from being a founder and executive director of a nonprofit humanitarian relief organization called the Bountiful Garden Foundation, Frank is also the inventor of Disc Hoops, the greatest team sport ever. So let's welcome Frank to the show, and he can tell us about that. Hi, Frank. How are you doing?
Hey, Frank.
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for having me.
Frank, I think the way I'd like to start is the way we usually start is we give a little background on the guests. So if you could give us a history, there's some interesting things that Tom mentioned there. One of them with the creation of that software that was, would you say it was better than Skype? It had some features that Skype didn't have?
It was in the year 2000, it was superior to Skype. It also had basically YouTube built into it because the server end, if you imagine Skype with the server being able to serve up videos, it also had elements of Slingbox in it, and it had elements of TiVo in it. It was an incredibly powerful software program that I had developed with one engineer. And I had basically embarrassed the entire middle management of the company I was working at. It's a long story. And this was my seminal work. This is the culmination of 20 years in software. And I presented it and was fired for it. Escorted out the door by a guy with a gun.
Wow. Okay, that'll definitely put a crimp in your style.
Right, this is going on, if you can remember, 2000. This is the point in the dot-com collapse. So, wow.
So, yeah.
So, at that point, I started looking for work. My friend was going through chemotherapy and radiation and surgery for her breast cancer, and, there just weren't any jobs on the market, so I kind of floundered around for a few years, and then she died, and just trying to find myself basically.
Did anything ever come of that program you wrote, or did the company that you worked for sort of claim it as their own? Did they take it?
No, the people that fired me, the middle management, shelved it. They were able to convince the CEO that it was all vaporware. It had gone against basically, in that era of the late 90s, everything was going to server-based software and away from applications. In the 80s and early 90s, there was a lot of application development. And then with the dawn of the Internet, everything went to be web-based. And so the fact that I had gone off and created a standalone client application that went along and connected to the server, that is exactly what you get with Skype, right? You get an application that you communicate through. that went against what they had decided was, the tactical future of the company. So they killed it.
And they were wrong.
Well, I mean, they would have been billionaires.
Yeah.
So they shelved it. From there, I went to try to build out something in a product that I called Universal Telecommunications. Basically, I wanted to put a telephony switch in every home in the world, which would blow up the telecommunications carrier's monopoly on the telephone system that they have. I'm not sure if you understand the implications of that, but if you could put a switch in every home on the planet, it would really dramatically alter the landscape or the ecosystem of what telephony is. And that had a ton of features in it. For instance, you can do universal voicemail. So if you wanted to send me a voicemail right now, there's really no way to do it. And in fact, what people call voicemail really isn't voicemail at all when you compare it to email. If you want to draft me an email, you don't need to know who my service provider is or, what kind of operating system I have or, all those details. You just draft an email, you type it, you draft it. If you want to send it to a group, if you want to reply, reply all, forward. All of those features that we've all grown to love in email.
Right.
Voicemail has none of that. And so about 10 years ago, I invented something called Universal Voicemail that allowed basically interoperability between all the different carriers in ways of transmitting and receiving voicemails. And this is possible by putting switches in everybody's homes.
Wow. And that didn't go through?
No, I couldn't raise money. I'm not someone who's experienced in raising money and being an entrepreneur. I just had this basically an extension of what I had gotten fired for, and I went off and extended it even further. I mean, nobody's done the things that I came up with Universal Telecommunications. It just has never been implemented. And over the last 6 or 7 years, with iPhones and Android phones, a lot of the features and functionalities of what Universal Telecommunications provided has been incorporated into the smartphones, but the underlying infrastructure, like I said, like universal voicemail, still doesn't exist.
Okay. Okay.
Does any of the applications that you had before when you invented that program apply today in some in any other type of program?
You mean the product that I got fired for, or the
yes.
one that?
Yeah, the product you got fired for.
There's bits and pieces all over. Like I said, there's YouTube and other streaming servers, but that's all web-based. No one's really doing that. I think Metacafe has a standalone browser to view their videos, and that's not a big success. People just like using browsers to watch videos. And then there's Skype, of course. So that's the main thing.
Right. Okay. Now, Frank has done two films. One is called Beyond Me, and the other one's called Beyond Belief. Now, you did both of these films with zero investment, zero help, and did basically the whole thing all by yourself. I recommend everybody watch both Beyond Me and Beyond Belief. We're going to have links to them on the past guests page where Frank will be there. I'll have both of them there as well, and you can go to his page. He's got a Kickstarter page where you can go and view them. Maybe you could give us just a brief description of both of those films, and maybe more importantly, what was the inspiration for them?
Right, and they're easy to find if you just go to beyondmefilm.com. I've got the link to the Kickstarter page because I'm trying to raise money for a third film, in which I want to travel to India and other places to film it. I'm not raising too much money, but it should be a phenomenal film. And I did my first two films also without any money and help. I also did them without any experience. So to explain the inspiration, I would have to sort of back up a few years.
Go ahead.
So after my after my train wreck of a life. And, I think the important point here isn't for people to feel sorry and say, well, Frank had this horrible thing happen to him, because that's not really the case. And I don't think I ever hit rock bottom. That's not really what it's about either. But, it's sort of a what's wrong with this picture kind of story. You know, you've got this guy who's extremely brilliant. I've been called genius by a lot of people. I don't even know what that means, but very intelligent, very athletic and competitive, and someone who's has seen a lot of success, and yet basically on paper, basically a failure and getting fired. And there was a lot of drug and alcohol abuse and substance abuse in my life. Divorce, single father with two kids. It was a pretty messed up life. And so, anytime you get fired for inventing a product that basically turned out to be a $3 billion product, there's something seriously wrong. And so, about 8 or 9 years ago, I started getting involved in Eastern mysticism. You had Michael Cremo on last week talking about the Vedantas, and I've studied a lot of that for the last 8 years, and I began doing a lot of practical exercises, pranayamas, bhastrika, yoga, meditation. And after about 4 years of doing this regularly, daily, multiple times per day, going on weekend retreats, really doing an intensive immersion into Eastern mysticism, I basically learned how to meditate, if that makes any sense. I don't think you ever completely stop learning. But I got to a point where I was able to get to a place of basically pure divine love or bliss for an hour every afternoon. It was really quite incredible. It's been described by some people as 1,000 times more intense than the sensations associated with an orgasm lasting for an hour. It's really quite incredible. Yeah,
can't beat that.
Can't beat that. And not only is it better than any drugs I've ever had, but it's not only doesn't have no negative side effects, it has a lot of positive side effects, which are fairly well documented. They help relieve post-traumatic stress relief, lower your cholesterol, lower your blood pressure, you sleep better, you become more creative, etc. And so I think normally anytime people get to that state of consciousness, the first thing they want to do is go shake someone, say, hey, you have no idea what you're missing. This is really quite incredible. And you get connected with your true essence. When you're in that state, it's really beyond words. And so initially I'd started writing a book called Beyond Me. That took a few years to write, and I never got it published. I'd completed the manuscript to the point where I think it was ready to be sent to an editor, but I never really went as far as getting it published and wasn't sure what to do with it. And I was speaking with a sister-in-law about it, and she's like, well, why do you want to publish a book anyway? I think she was kind of cynical. And I thought about it for a second, and immediately the thought that I had that came to me is, well, I want to help people. And instantaneously, I also had the same thought, well, I'll just do a documentary. it's just sort of how I roll.
Wow.
So what the hell? I don't have any experience. I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I'm just going to make a documentary film. And because I had already written the book, I had the first draft of Beyond Me completed in 3 weeks.
Mm. I'm just going to jump here and say, for someone who has no experience making a film, watching that film, I was like, wow, this is really good. You had the slow zoom in. Like you picture it, Frank sitting by a stream in the woods, and he's got a slow zoom in coming when he's talking. I was like, oh, that's awesome. That's great. And
I love the scenery myself.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. And then I talked to him, and he said, oh, I've never actually done that before. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. and there wasn't a cameraman behind the camera during the Zoom.
Yeah, which is what a question I asked him. I said, oh, that was cool. You got your cameraman to do that. And he goes, I didn't have a cameraman. I was like, okay, that's pretty good then. Yeah, very impressive. Very impressive documentaries, both of them. And it, so it started out being a book, and then you decided, ah, what the heck, I'll make a documentary. And you made that documentary so that, and then you ended up making a second one, and now you're going to make a third one. So this, how did the second one come about?
So the second one came about. I got a lot of blowback, especially here in the West, because the first one, Beyond Me, is really for probably a large portion of your listening audience.
Okay.
Some of it's going to be rehashed. You know, you've got Bruce Lipton on there talking about, you know, cellular biology and, you know, some of the things that are in there. Of course, there's reincarnation. A lot of people have heard about reincarnation, but there's a news clip in there that's fairly compelling. But there's no one's really ever been able to put together sort of the fabric that I've weaved in this documentary that explains how, you know, all of the behaviors and the traits and tendencies that we have that all make us suffer and make us get fired for inventing phenomenal products and, you know, have dysfunctional families, all of those traits and tendencies associated with personality disorders and mental illnesses are all instinctive, and I make a very compelling case for that. And I debated whether or not to even include reincarnation in that film because it's controversial here in the West, and a lot of people just don't accept it. But I think you would agree if I took out reincarnation, then the whole story kind of falls apart.
I would agree. It's a big part of the film.
Right. It's a huge part, and it also extends Darwinian theory, and it makes sense out of evolution. It alters modern psychoanalytic theory. It's very compelling when you look at reincarnation in the context of Beyond Me. It really sheds new light. And it provides a very good healing for people. They watch the film, and they realize that their suffering really, you know, certainly a lot of it can be traced back to their parents and their mother and their father and all those kind of things. But when you look in the grand picture, that's not really what it's about. And you can sort of move on and let a lot of that stuff go.
Right, exactly.
But I did get a lot of blowback about the reincarnation because it's so foreign to people. And it's something that's not accepted here in the West. It's considered blasphemous and heretical. And given everything that I have learned vis-a-vis the Vedantas and Vedic history and knowledge, I just knew that Jesus would have had to have taught reincarnation and meditation. There's just no way he couldn't have.
Right.
It's such an important aspect to our minds, to our consciousness, who we are and how we got to be the way we are. It's impossible he would have left that out. You know, every other great master has all basically, when you get to the point of understanding meditation and how to do it and what it's like, then all of a sudden all the different teachings from all the different masters sounds exactly the same. Even though every book from the Bhagavad Gita to the Quran to the Torah and everything else has been altered and misinterpreted by human hands, once you had come from it from the perspective of a meditator, then all of a sudden these are all saying the same thing. So why would Jesus be the one person who's different from everyone else? So I went on a search. You know, I'd always heard stories, and there's documentaries and books. There's been books for 150 years about Jesus in India. There's the Aquarius Gospel or something like that, and a lot of other books have been written for 150 years. So that was nothing new, and it's sort of common knowledge in the East. You know, people just accept it.
It is common knowledge in a lot of the Eastern traditions.
Right.
That Christ spent time in the East.
Right. So that wasn't so shocking to me, but and I wanted to cover this reincarnation story, and I had heard that reincarnation was in something that was called the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas was discovered in 1945. I guess people have known about it for centuries because it they found fragments of it, and there's little Greek parchments, and people have known about it forever. But there hasn't been a complete version of it found until 1945. And it was made famous in the film The Da Vinci Code, and there was another movie called Stigmata that was famous for it. But I had never read it. And so I started to do this research for, you know, I was looking for where Jesus would have taught about reincarnation. And so a few months ago, I read the Gospel of Thomas, and instantly I recognized it as Vedas. I mean, it was pure Vedantic knowledge. And I was kind of shocked. And okay. It was like, oh my God, this is exactly the same things I've been learning for the last 8 years. And it was really quite, you know, really quite disturbing. To an extent. And then the more research that I did, the more evidence I found that not only did he do his training in India, and basically anywhere he can go, to Tibet and even Greece and Alexandria and Egypt to learn from all the great masters and traditions, but he was buried in Kashmir when he died at the age of 100 years old. And this was the part that I lost sleep over for a few nights because it was just so startling to me.
Okay. So there must have been... so then he didn't die on the cross?
Well, he might have. He may have. He may not have. I tend to think that he probably did. How long was he dead? You know, the cross scene itself was very strange. Usually it takes... you know, sometimes days, sometimes as much as a week for someone to die on the cross. And if they're not dying, what they do is they break the legs. One thing I learned on this is that the reason you die when you're crucified is you die from asphyxiation. You suffocate because you can't breathe.
Yep.
And so what they do is they break your legs so that you can't support yourself and you die quicker if you're not dead within a few days. And, you know, it's very controversial that they did it on a Friday because of the Jewish Sabbath. He couldn't be hanging there on a Saturday. So, and they never broke his legs. He probably was only on the cross for 3 hours, which is very strange. Like, okay, that's really typically not very long for someone to die, especially if you can take into account that he's this, trained yogi who's got this phenomenal body control and can probably slow his... you know, the respiratory system down to a slow pulse. So did he die or did he not die? I know that they brought 100 pounds of healing herbs to the tomb where they brought him. You know, Joseph of Arimathea brought, you know, in the Bible they say they brought 100 pounds of aloe and other healing herbs. They didn't bring embalming fluids, they brought healing herbs. So what does that mean? Did he actually die? Maybe he died and he was dead for an hour, you know, like people do with near-death experiences.
Did a yogic practice that slowed his breathing and heart down to the point where anybody checking him who didn't have a deep knowledge, and back then they didn't, would just pronounce him dead.
I had an experience about 5 or 6 years ago where I was meditating and I stopped breathing and my heart stopped beating for about 10 minutes. And I'm not trained, and this is actually, it's kind of a one-time thing. It hasn't happened since. It was incredible. So if I can do that for 10 minutes and I'm not trained and I'm just sort of a rookie, if someone is an expert, how long can they do that for? I've heard that Indians can do that or yogis can do that for a few hours.
Yep, there's been yogis tested in the lab. If anybody out there wants to read about it, you can read about it in a book called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. The section you want to go to is The Yogi in the Lab. They did all the tests on him. He stopped his breathing, stopped his heart, did all kinds of stuff. He was tested in Russia, so that was the book you want to look for, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. Also, another one is a book called Magic and Mystery in Tibet. If you can find that book, it's hard to get a hold of, but if you can find that book, it talks all about the sort of yogic practices and what they can do.
Right, and there was another incident where I guess he was, I don't know if he's thirsty, but they put some gall and vinegar on a sponge and put it up to his lips. And this would have been like smelling salts. This would have been something that, would have woken somebody else up. And instead, when they did this, he immediately went into a sleep or died or went into a trance. So there's speculation that there was, again, some herbs or some drugs, something that would put him under and put him into some sort of comatose state or something that made him appear to be dead. I don't know. The message of the crucifixion is, again, no different from the Vedantas in that it says we're not our bodies. So I don't have any issue with whether he died or didn't die, or if that doesn't change anything in his profound teachings.
Right.
So it shouldn't matter to Christians whether or not that's actually what happened.
So the story carries on after that. Okay, after that, he would have to have traveled somewhere. Can you pick up the story from the when he left that area? Where would he have gone then?
Sure. I mean, he had in the Pistis Sophia, which is another of the books discovered in Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1945. He was talking to the apostles some 11 years after the crucifixion. And that was around Syria. So he spent time in Syria and Turkey. And there's around 30 books, ancient texts from Turkey to Syria, Iran, Persia, throughout the entire Middle East and the East that have references to him traveling to the East. So we don't know exactly when he settled in Kashmir. There's evidence that his mother Mary was also buried in Kashmir as well. As well as Moses, too, which is kind of surprising. So apparently at one point Jesus was holding onto Moses' staff, which was buried with, some tomb that Moses had somewhere in the same place in Kashmir. All very fascinating stuff.
Wow. Okay.
Right. It really quite incredible. And there's a book, I reference it in the film, I can't pronounce the name of it off the top of my head, but the king that was in that area at the time, meets this person from the East who describes, what had happened to him, that he was crucified by his own people. And this would have been around the year 80. So this is some 40 or 50 years after the crucifixion. And this is all documented in India.
Okay. So, and he must have, he died at what age? What age would he have died, and where would he have been when he died? I'm sure there's a lot of going on between there, that those time periods, but maybe you could tell us the story about where he traveled, who he talked to.
Right. He and this is it's a little bit sketchy. We do know, if we can believe what we're told, that he's buried in the Srinagar area in Kashmir at some place called the Rosabal Shrine, and the shrine is still there to this day. There are in the East, there's a tradition with masters to make basically engravings of imprints of footprints for Buddha's graves, for instance. They put these footprints. And so the engravings at this particular site in Srinagar have scars on them, on the feet, basically in the same location that a nail would have been driven through the feet.
Oh, okay.
It's quite startling when you look at all the evidence that's presented in Beyond Belief, which is the film that I've created about Jesus. So some documents say he died at the age of 115. Others say that he died around 90. Some say he died around 100. It's really hard to tell exactly what age he is. Did he have children? The king that I was referencing, apparently when Jesus was around the age of 80, the king said, look, you're... you're getting too old to take care of yourself. You need to have a wife and be taken care of. And so there's speculation that he married a local woman there and had children with her. So there's right now actually some DNA testing going on. The skeleton is still in the body in the grave at the Rosabal Shrine. And they want to do some genetic testing and test that against the indigenous people in the area. There's strong evidence to suggest that two of the lost tribes of Israel are, you know, in Afghanistan, and they're all Muslims now, which makes the whole, you know, Middle Eastern war thing kind of funny. That it's quite ironic, really, that the you know, the same people that are fighting each other are basically brothers and sisters, and they just don't know it.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite literally, brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting, very interesting. Okay, Tom, do you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to know, in the time that he was in these areas, did he have any contact with any of the apostles or any of the people that, you know, continue his work, like Paul?
Well, with Paul... apparently, you know, allegedly never met Jesus, although that's quite interesting. Paul had this vision in Damascus, on the road to Damascus. This is 14 years after the crucifixion. And so traditional theologians have always thought, well, that's interesting, he never met Jesus. But, you know, it's altogether possible that actually he did meet Jesus, and, you know, and people have never really understood that. Or perhaps Jesus was in Kashmir at that point, and actually he never did meet him. The Apostle Thomas, and by the way, apostle simply means teacher, from the, I guess, the Latin or the Greek word that it's derived from.
Okay.
So so Jesus trained these teachers, gave them a teacher training course, and sent them around the world, typically in pairs. So I believe Thomas went to India with someone by the name of Barnabas, if I remember that correctly. So it's altogether possible, since Thomas, I mean, it's very well documented and accepted that Thomas went to India. He built a dozen or 13 churches there. You know, for people who look at sort of logistical issues with regards to, well, could Jesus have gotten there, and what about language barriers and things like that? You know, we know for a fact that Thomas did and other people did, and it really wasn't an issue. There was a spice route, which was by sea, and then there was a silk route, which went through by land. So there was ways of getting to the east. The language wasn't a barrier. So, and in answer to your question, Tommy, you do have apostles traveling to India and Jesus moving around in India, so it's altogether likely that they were able to somehow communicate after Jesus had gone on over there.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of stories about, Holy Blood, Holy Grail has a story about the descendants of Christ, if I remember correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the descendants of Christ and Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, that's something that I'm not too sure about. There's so much, when you start diving into all the documentation that's out there, that's been burned or destroyed, and you've got a parchment here, you've got the, you know, the Gospel of Mary, which also was found at Nag Hammadi.
Yeah, the Nag Hammadi,
Right. We do know that Mary migrated to France. There's a lot of stories, both from the... you know, I discovered this whole thing called the Church of the East, which I don't even know if is legitimate or if it's not legitimate. But they've got several documents, and they've got a whole bunch of stories, and nobody's ever heard of the Church of the East. But it's you know, it's they've got their own version of the Gospel of Thomas. They've got the Acts of Thomas. They've got a book called the Acts of Jesus, which is quite interesting. And
that is interesting.
That's fascinating. In the Acts of Jesus, it tells a lot about Jesus' time in India. I can't give that book any credibility. It's very interesting. I've read it, but I couldn't include that in my documentary, for instance, because there's no, you know, I don't understand the pedigree of the book, where it came from, and, you know, who wrote it. And, But it does have some very interesting stories about Mary Magdalene, in that she was a 14-year-old, very sexy woman that was put in the ashram with Jesus, and they both spent months in a hut, basically nude. And this was sort of one of Jesus's last trials by fire, to, you know, to not succumb to this temptress. And so what happened, not only did he not succumbed to her, but he trained her in those 3 months, and she became this enlightened being herself. And so when she traveled, I know. Well, you know, who knows? It's an interesting story. I don't know how much validity there is.
Well, I mean, the point of your third documentary, which will be called Beyond Reason. The first one is Beyond Me. The second one is Beyond Belief. The third one, Beyond Reason, is that's not been made yet. But that the point of that is you want to travel to the East and weave together some of this these historical references.
The Beyond Reason is going to be significantly deeper down the rabbit hole from a spiritual point of view. And one of the things about Beyond Belief that shouldn't be negated here, which is really the spiritual implications of what I'm suggesting happened. That, you know, in reality, what Christianity, and basically 1800 to 1700 years ago, Christianity was fractured into two distinct sort of families. There was the European brand, which basically evolved into the Roman Catholics, and then there was the other version that was, you know, centered around Egypt and Syria and Palestine, and that was, some people call it Gnosticism, although that's kind of a sketchy way to describe it. But really, what that version of Christianity was a modified form of Hinduism, and so it's quite shocking to see that actually, you know, the one that was squashed out by the Roman Empire happened to be the same sort of spirituality that's taught in the same area of the world that he's purported to have traveled to, and so I've gone quite a bit different in Beyond Belief in making a case on the spiritual side of things. And talking about, you know, really not from a historical point of view. Certainly there's some evidence that I use in the film that says, okay, here's what documentation we have. You know, the Romans and the Vatican have burned up just about everything they could, sort of a scorched earth policy. But we have been able to find a few fragments, and here's the evidence I'm presenting. But really the most solid evidence of all is the spiritual knowledge within in the Gospel of Thomas, which is sort of like a fingerprint match for the knowledge, the spiritual knowledge that's in the Vedantas. And I have sort of this spiritual sparring match with a Yale professor who was kind enough to allow me to use his discourse on the Gospel of Thomas in Beyond Belief. And he's going through these passages which most Christians just couldn't even understand because they don't really make any sense. They're very esoteric.
Right.
And then you've got me presenting what I believe are my own personal interpretations of them based on the knowledge that I've gained over the last 10 years in studying the Vedas.
Yeah, that was I found that to be a very interesting part of the film. This gentleman, highly educated gentleman, was going through the passages and saying, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. And then Frank comes on and says, I think it means this. And I was like, well, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I thought it was great the way you presented, you know, your ideas, and it was
right. My approach was with the entire film was to be a defense attorney, so I'm not really trying to. It's a very sensitive subject, and I'm not trying to put anybody down. But it's just sort of, hey, look, here's what I think, and you know, and you're the jury, and you're sequestered for an hour watching my film, and. You know, come to your own conclusions. This makes an awful lot of sense. Mm. And if it does, the ramifications and implications of what I'm suggesting here are enormous. That, you know, basically Christianity got hijacked by the Roman government, and we're still living today under the legacy of decisions that were made 1700 years ago by politicians.
Well, there was no doubt on that one, because when they decided on which canons to use, you know, they done away with the rest, and of course the rest was probably more important than what they kept.
Yeah, that was the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah.
Well, there were several. I mean, it went on for a few hundred years, and then Empress Theodora was instrumental in the Fifth Ecumenical Council of Nicaea, where they were able to eliminate all the last vestiges of reincarnation from the Bible. So it went on for hundreds of years, but the whole. You know, you don't need to think. We'll do your thinking for you. And anybody who thinks different, we're going to kill. you know, you're either one of us or you're either for us or you're against us kind of thing.
You're either a believer or a heretic.
Yep.
Right. Well, right. That Christianity was split between the believers and the knowers. And, you know, I became a knower when I started to learn how to meditate 4 years ago. I mean, once you know from direct experience, you know. There's no belief, there's no reason to believe anything.
Do you think Jesus at the time when he's, you know, he's in India, was aware of what the other individuals were doing, like Paul and the apostles and, you know, what was going on in Europe in general there?
I'm still researching some of that. I mean, you have to understand, most of the apostles were assassinated around the year 60. This is about 4 or 5 years before the war in Jerusalem, the revolt. So this is about, you know, 25 years after the crucifixion, and Christianity had already spread its wings, you know, and taken root in Europe, in Turkey, etc. And so the original teachers were all killed, you know, within a few decades. And so what they were teaching, we're not really sure, and we know that it was fairly fractured. You know, in other words, what Matthew was teaching was different from what Peter was teaching. And they all had their slight variations. And of course, you know, I mean, I've been, look at it this way. I actually wasn't going to be a teacher. And I've been studying this for 8 years. I can study for another 20 years. And maybe by then I'll start to be able to be a teacher. These people had no real background in what Jesus was teaching. And he only was able to teach them for 2 or 3 years. And there's a lot of evidence, even in the Bible itself, there's statements where these guys really didn't understand. You know, Jesus only had a few years. He taught them as much as they could, and he set them off, and then he went away. And then they went off teaching their own interpretations. And so there was a lot of different versions of Christianity over the first few centuries.
Right, but I mean, Paul, I would think, was the guy who basically set up what eventually became Christianity, in a sense, because
the Roman version of Christianity.
Yeah, well, whatever you want to call it, but I mean, whatever his ideal was, and ideas mm-hmm. that he projected up, you know, to his churches, is what made it, you know, in the future canons and. You know, all the controversies that were going on prior to eventually were settled in his favor.
Yes and no. I mean, that's true. And he was sort of the, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do kind of guy. He said he's all things to all people. And so he was the great compromiser who did whatever he could basically to recruit people. So he definitely compromised a lot. But at the same time, there's a lot of evidence that a lot of sort of the letters and the epistles that are included in the Bible that are attributed to him, he didn't write. And so even that gets pretty muddy, that there's a lot of falsities and forgeries that have his name on them that he wasn't really responsible for. So it's even hard to tell what he did and what he didn't do. But yeah, he's definitely blamed, and I don't know how responsible he is for what the people call the Pauline version of Christianity, or the European version. It's rather unfortunate, and it has very little to do with, you know, the stuff that I have learned over the last 8 years with right. consciousness and all the things that are in my two films.
The other thing, too, is I would kind of be surprised that if Jesus, you know, had heard what was going on during that period, would he not take a track down and just set things straight to some degree?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I've actually been starting to win arguments with Jehovah's Witnesses.
Okay, you need to make a how-to DVD on that.
It's pretty simple. I mean, okay, they say Jesus was the only Son of God. Do you know the Lord's Prayer?
Yeah.
What's the first words?
Our Father, who art in heaven.
Right, exactly. He didn't say my Father. Right? So that's one argument right there. That shuts them up pretty quickly. And then the other one is about Judas. And, okay, let's just say that I'm an enlightened master, right? I've achieved God consciousness. Do you really think that you can sell me out for 30 pieces of gold?
I mean, if you obtain, and if I'm not going to know about it?
Right. So back to your question, if Jesus had attained God consciousness, don't you think he knew what was going on? He's back in his cave in Kashmir meditating. And so you have to figure that this is all part of some grand plan.
Yeah, but I mean, considering that he would have been, you know, almost 70 years over there, you know, and knowing what may have been going on, you know, in and around, you know, where he lived and surrounding areas, and by that particular time period, a lot went on in how Christianity was being built.
Well, a lot went on. I agree with you, Tom. A lot went on. But if you take the Council of Nicaea and that sort of stuff, that was 300 AD, unless I've got my numbers wrong.
Yeah, that was a couple of hundred years later.
Right.
But and that had a major impact as well. So.
Yeah, but I mean, as Christianity was growing at that time, you know, from the time that they were being thrown to the lions and, you know, when the thing started to switch around, you know, there was a lot of controversy. There was a lot of things that were going on. And you would think that if there was something interesting that he would have saw, he might have took a step that way.
You know, I had exactly all these same thoughts when I came to this realization that he was still hanging out. And like I said, you know, he'd attained God consciousness. He knew what was going on. And I suspect he thought he was probably in the best position to, you know, do what he wanted to be able to do where he was.
Yeah, but I mean, there wasn't the kind of noise that was made when he was in his own area compared to what he may have done, you know, in India or any of the areas that he was at later. If he, you know, he was one of the masters and he went out there, you'd think there would have been a lot more people that would have known of him and maybe followed him on the same sort of level of whatever his teachings that he was trying to do.
You mean like on a Gnostic level?
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, he had followers over there and he was trying to create some sort of, you know.
To a degree, right. But then again, he who has the biggest army wins, and Rome had the biggest army.
Yeah, but you see, this is the one thing that you know, I don't think people understood of the times. Jesus and a lot of these fellows that were, you know, so-called preaching, you know, that we call preaching today, for the time was to get their people up and excited to go against, you know, the oppressors. It wasn't so much, you know, teaching them how to be humble and how to be nice and how to do this and that you know, is put in the Bible. These guys were actually, you know, people that try to get their people up to go and fight. And the so-called cousin...
Jesus wasn't.
Well, again, that's the way we're being sold in the Bible. As the
No. This is what I've learned from the Eastern traditions. Jesus wasn't that kind of person at all. That was more John the Baptist and other people. Jesus was, you know, he was a peaceful man, and everything was about peace.
Yeah, but if you see, this is where the story gets kind of muddy to me. When, you know, for years, he you know, he's doing this teaching, you know, in the small little towns outside of Jerusalem. Because, why? Because he was afraid to go into to do it in a big way, because, like his cousin, his head went the wrong way. Right?
Jesus knew no fear.
Well, again, this is what we're being sold.
No, he was a master. Masters do not know fear.
Okay. But if why would he go at the time that he went to Jerusalem, knowing what would happen if he said something?
Exactly. That's right. That's a good question. So he knew exactly what was going to happen. Before he left
India.
Yeah,
but he would have known that even before. That's why he wasn't teaching anywhere in the big place. He was teaching somewhere in the little dinky places. Right? And that applied to all these guys in those days. Because if they would have gone to a big town where there would have been a lot of Roman armies and they would have been seen, you know, congregating somewhere with a whole bunch of people, they would have had their heads cut off. So they would hang around the little towns where there wasn't much, you know, people that would give them a hassle.
So what you're saying is Jesus didn't go out of his way to be murdered sooner. Okay, I'm gonna give him bonus points.
But at the same time, when he's working the small crowds, right, it doesn't create enough influence to, like, if he was talking to, let's say, 10 people or 20 people, you know, how much people could he have possibly been talking to in those little dinky places? Some of these towns didn't have more than 50 people.
Right.
I'm still missing your point. So what?
No, but I'm saying so he was non-influential for the longest time until he went into Jerusalem and died. Prior to that, you know, for those two or three years that, you know, when the Bible describes it, you know, they talk about stories of what he did and, you know, what he said, but he wouldn't have been doing it to any big crowd to create any kind of influence.
Which I think is a smart thing. So again, I'm giving him bonus points for not getting dead earlier.
Okay, from that perspective, yes. But how would he have created enough influence to make him a big shot?
But yeah, how can you sit here 2,000 years later and say that he failed?
Well, no. See, this is where you see religion. That's how religion works. It's other people that create the religion. It's not. He wasn't trying to create a religion. You know, he did his thing. And then a whole bunch of people picked up and brought it to whatever degree it is today.
He came to change the world. He changed the world. He wasn't a Christian, obviously.
Well, we're sorry, but we got to take a quick break right now. And we'll see you guys on the other side.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
Hello, this is Scott Jordan, and I would personally like to thank all of our listeners for their emails of encouragement. It means a great deal to us. All of Spectrum shows are available in two formats, an MP3 stream you can listen to on our site, as well as a YouTube version. All of Spectrum shows are full-length and free to listen to, and if I have my way, always will be. Tom and myself do all this work out of pocket, and freely give our time and effort to giving you, the listener, the best, most informative experience possible. I would also like to thank our listeners who have donated in the past to help with our expenses. Every donation goes directly to keeping the project alive. Thank you, enjoy, and keep listening.
If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
Let's look at the actual spiritual knowledge that we have from the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Mary, all these other documents that were found at Nag Hammadi. Compare them with Vedic religion and see that that's where he trained. And when he came back to Jerusalem, he was such a threat to the established religion at the time.
Right, because he was taking Far Eastern teachings and basically spreading them in a highly religious area.
Well, they had their own. They were contradicting. The Western religions.
Right. Good way to get yourself killed. It's interesting because there have been other people that have made stirs and gotten in trouble for it all through history. And we know them, and they may not all be religious figures. Copernicus, you know, one example. Tesla, another example. You know, there's been people that have challenged the established thought of the time and paid for it. I mean, this is a recurring cycle over and over in human history.
I am a heretic. And when beyond belief, there's a very good definition for what a heretic is. And, you know, for better or for worse, being a heretic is a double-edged sword. It's a very lonely life at times because I simply don't think the same way other people do.
And what does the word heretic mean?
There's this guy, Bishop Irenaeus, was one of the first people who, he had this village in France in the second century that was completely wiped out, I think, one night. And his basic stance was that we can't afford to be scattered in our belief systems. We need a central belief system because otherwise we're too weak and we're going to get slaughtered because there was all these different, I mean, there were hundreds of different factions of Christianity. Right today, there are 72 different sects on this planet, Christian sects. And I've heard numbers as high as 20,000. You know, I mean, Christianity just sort of splintered and fractured all over. You had different people interpreting it different ways and taking it off and establishing their own belief systems. So Bishop Irenaeus coined the word orthodox. And ortho we recognize from orthodontry or whatever, and that means straight or correct. And doxy is thinking. So orthodoxy just simply means straight thinking or correct thinking, whereas heterodox, which was the word, where the word heretic comes from, simply means somebody who thinks differently. You know, think Steve Jobs at Apple,
right.
Or think Frank Huguenard. You know, I got fired for it 10 years ago because I thought differently.
And you didn't learn your lesson, and you're thinking differently again.
Right? Well, I can't. You can't make. It's just that's how I'm wired. I can't think like you do. I can't think like Tom does. It's just how I work.
You were born a heretic and just got bigger.
Yeah.
I was born a heretic, right? That's definitely true.
That can be a good thing, though. We need different thinkers. The world needs. But unfortunately, you know what happens to different thinkers, don't you?
Yeah, of course.
First
thing. You know, when I first saw your film, right, I called Scott and I said, you know, we have to have this Frank guy on because I love the way he thinks. Because, you know, the right now, you know, I'm playing devil's advocate with you with a lot of this stuff, right? But it takes a real thinker to come up with the approaches that you took in your film.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, a lot of folks, you know, always look at things too literal. You know, they don't look in depth.
People have so much invested in their egos. Their entire, you know, I'm reading a lot of stuff now that I'm working on for Beyond Reason, which we really haven't touched on yet, and about really how, you know, and again, this is straight out of Vedanta, that really none of this exists. This conversation doesn't even exist. One of the things that's really cool to me, and you've all heard that basically we live in a holographic universe, correct? Yeah. And that none of this is real.
Tell
but me. the epiphany I had this week is sort of radical. There's a definition of truth that Jesus said and others, it sounds good to me, is that that which doesn't change is true. and everything else, anything that changes is not real. Okay? Meaning that this entire universe is not real, which corresponds with that whole holographic universe theory.
Yeah.
So what's really cool about that is that universal consciousness, which is what Einstein called the field, and is the substrate that holds everything together, the thought that has created the universe, universal consciousness also isn't real and doesn't exist.
Right. Anything that changes doesn't exist.
Right, and universal consciousness changes. It's like, oh, okay. I'm okay with, that these walls and this room doesn't exist, but actually the consciousness behind it, that doesn't exist either. That's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. It's a very deep thought.
Right. So that's what's going into Beyond Reason, and I'm hoping to travel to India to interview as many swamis and yogis and rishis as possible who can all articulate that, basically to use logic to out-logic these people who have so much invested in their egos. As I was saying, people are really reluctant to give up. You know, all the what we call experience of reality that we're having is basically a projection of our own minds. And so if you have somebody who thinks differently and is basically saying, sorry, whatever you're projecting, it's wrong, but that doesn't go over very well. And sometimes you get killed, and sometimes you get fired.
Right. Sometimes J.P. Morgan says, where do I put a meter on that thing?
Exactly.
Sometimes the people in power say, no. The sun revolves around Earth, not the other way around. Go back into your corner.
Yeah, we've put too much... we've got too much on the table on that one. Sorry. We're going to have to keep going down this road.
This happens over and over. And it's funny how the ones you hear about, at least, are the ones that are vindicated later. Like, Michael Cremo was talking about a geologist team that went over to identify the ground in which a skeleton was dug up. The layer in which it was dug up in, and they had this team of geologists come in to date the dig, and they did four separate different radiological dating techniques on it and came up with a date of millions of years. So they were like, no, that's not possible. The archaeologist said, no, that's not possible. Since we're following the, Darwinian outlook, then it must be within a 200 and, it had to be within a window. 280,000 years, I think it was. So they threw out this team of highly professional geologists' report and said, okay, we're not going to use your stuff. Well, the lead geologist was so angry about that, they published their own report. And the backlash from her doing that was she lost tenure. I don't know if you know about how difficult it is to lose tenure, but it's not. It's usually if you get tenure, you're in. You're good to go. She got removed from her position, lost tenure, everything. She was destroyed. And then this is the way it happens. If you buck the system destroys your life. And this has been represented over and over and over and over through history, human history. We just can't seem to learn the open-minded lesson of, yeah, sure, okay. If that's what your findings are, then let's just put that out there.
In the world of academia, it's the worst.
Academic arrogance. Yeah. Knowledge filtration.
You look at Steve Jobs, Steve got fired.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, he brought in John Sculley from Pepsi, and a few years later, Steve got fired, went off and started Next, and floundered for about 12 years. They brought him back, and when they brought him back, he had one share of stock. He was holding on to his first share of stock or whatever, just sort of symbolically. And now, as of, I think, today or tomorrow, Apple's the biggest company in the world. It's talk about vindication. You don't get it. You don't get it any better than that.
Yeah. Well, not too many people get a second chance. That's not something that generally happens. Is you got to be a certain individual or just get lucky to get the second chance. And it worked out well for Steve. You know,
so. You look at all these stories. The guy who started FedEx, and it was a senior thesis, and the professor said, you know, gave him an F on it, said this is a stupid idea. You know, there's all kinds of stories about that. It's, you know, and it's the kind of, I mean, I live a few miles from Apple, and they used to have these huge, gigantic banners on the side of their building of Einstein or John Lennon and all this, you know, think differently. And the world, you know, the world travels and works through people who think differently, but they usually, you know, heretics more times than not are the ones who suffer a lot because they're swimming in a sea of very ignorant people.
That's true. Yeah, I've heard many stories. The work that we've done on interviewing people in the free energy field. Boy, you want to get in trouble, Frank? you want to seriously get in trouble? Try working in the free energy field. There are certain things that you can do that you'll, you know, get a lot of emotional backlash from people. But if you want the intelligence agencies interested in what you do, invent a free energy device.
what happens to our global economy right now if I turn the switch on free energy?
How is it now? I mean, can it get any worse? I suppose it could.
It's completely driven by this by oil.
Right.
Right? I mean, what happens to all those, you know, if the Saudis can no longer buy our bonds because they don't have any more money?
Maybe a crash is what we need.
Well, we absolutely do need it. I'm just saying that's why there's so much pressure on status quo, because
right.
our entire economic system is based on status quo. That if
right.
there was a disruption in the way that oil is converted into cash in this world, our entire financial system would be in turmoil,
right.
which I agree would be a great thing. And, you know, it'll happen. And, I'm more optimistic than I ever have been about the future of mankind and the planet Earth. I think we're in great shape. The question is how rough are we going? What kind of rough period are we going to go through?
But I don't know. How rough do you think it's going to be?
I don't know. Not so bad.
Not so bad.
But I do know that evolution never happens on a beach, you know, in 70-degree weather. You know, in other words, if you look back on the planet over the last billion years, evolution's always happened the most rapidly mm-hmm. under the most extreme and harsh conditions. You know, an asteroid.
Just a quick question. Can that beach have girls in skimpy bikinis?
Sure.
And margaritas involved?
That's what I'm talking about.
All right.
That's 500 million years and nothing happening on that beach.
I sort of like the sound of that beach. Can we just do it for, I don't know, 200 million years?
See,
the evolving after?
that's hell.
Nah.
See, that's what people don't understand, that actually hell, we're living in hell right now.
Yeah. I agree.
Which is kind of funny about how the Christians have it all turned around, that you're going to go to hell, blah, blah, blah. It's like we're in hell, and if you don't get it right, you're going to be in hell again next lifetime and the next one and the next one.
Right, I agree.
You know, that life, you know, because that life on the beach, there's decay, right? You know, for 10 or 15 years, everybody's nice and sexy, but, you know, we get old and our teeth fall out and we get ugly and you don't want to see what's going on the inside.
Well, we're not actually, you know, we're just hanging out on the beach and not swimming. We get fat too. We get fat and ugly.
Right.
No evolution there. Well, I suppose there's a sort of evolution, but de-evolution, as Michael Cremo would say.
De-evolution.
De-evolution. And I think we are de-evolving right now at this point. And I don't know. Maybe something will come up. Maybe something will happen. Hopefully something will happen. But, you know, that goes with what I was talking with you about and with Jason Gregory about, is it's not all, you can't get hung up on the doom and the gloom and the fear. And the reason you can't, and I'd like you to talk about this, actually, because this is something you feel very strongly about.
Right, and this is actually why I made the first film, Beyond Me, in the first place. And, you know, we haven't really talked about that film at all, and that one's really the profound one.
Let's go for it.
A lot of really deep knowledge. You know, at the end of it, I make a strong case for the human biocomputer model. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people sort of use that as an analogy and sort of kind of brush it off and say, oh, yeah, these mental problems we have are like computer viruses, and we'll just delete the file. It's like, wait a second. If getting rid of computer viruses was that easy, it wouldn't be a trillion-dollar industry for, you know, things like Norton antivirus and stuff. You know, we've all had those really nasty viruses on our computers that, you know, you get rid of, and then you reboot your machine, and there it is again, and then you scrub your hard disk, and it's still there. And that's what some of our deeper, you know, problems with our egos are. There's like these computer viruses that are extraordinarily sophisticated and impossible to remove from our system. And the ego is, you know, the ego's persistence. You know, if you look at instincts in animals and how instincts are all about survival of the species and keeping the animals alive and procreation, in the ego's case, the ego is all about survival of the ego, and it will do anything to save itself. And so in the human biocomputer, we vibrate in one of three frequency domains: fear, hate, or love. And this is really important because when you're vibrating in fear, it's basically like turning off your antivirus software, turning off your firewall on your router, and plugging directly into the internet without any protection. And you're able to, and you're very suggestible or programmable from that standpoint. And, you know, basically anybody who wants to control you, all they have to do is put you in fear, and then they can tell you whatever you want and you'll believe it. It'll go straight into your consciousness. And that's exactly what religions do, and that's exactly what the NBC Nightly News does and every other cable news network.
And MK Ultra got pretty good at it as well.
Exactly.
And, you break down the personality, you split the personality off, so it's a clean slate, tabula rasa, and then you program that one to do what you want it to do.
Right.
And this is done in smaller increments or in less obvious ways throughout exactly what you said, the media and different things like that.
Throughout the media, throughout, really throughout the world. And so even on the internet. And I went to great lengths on both of my films and my third one as well to really stay away from anything that's going to induce fear. Certainly with the entire Christian story, it's very easy to talk about, the lions and how things were distorted and things. And I made every effort to eliminate that just because it does bring up those vibrations, and you really want people to vibrate at a higher level. So, you know, I've basically turned off my TV, and, I'm not too interested in what's going on the outside world. There's nothing I can do about it, and the important thing is to have a good attitude. And the more people on this planet that have good attitudes, the better off we'll be.
Yeah. Yeah, Beyond Me was definitely a very interesting work that you did there. And what you were talking a great deal about meditation and the importance of meditation, and trying to avoid the doom and gloom fear stuff, that was a smart move. I like that.
Right, and you know, I think probably the films would have been viewed a million times by now if I had incorporated some of that in there, because somehow people are really addicted to that kind of thing. It, you know, they have a feeling of anxiety, and they like feeling that. They don't want to have a film that's just, you know, I guess my films are kind of boring in that sense, because it doesn't have that anxiety-ridden, you know, things about the Federal Reserve and, the monster of Jekyll Island and, you know, MK Ultra, whatever else you want to talk about that people have done.
And here talking about it, it's not like you don't know about it, because you're saying these things that are key words about that whole behind-the-scenes system. It's not that you don't know about this, that you're not naive. You're just saying, look, I don't want to scare anybody.
I want to be very positive and uplifting and, you know, inspire people and motivate people to meditate. You know, that's really the theme in all of my films is meditation. Like I said, I learned how to meditate a few years ago. If I miss a day, you know, it's a bummer. And, you know, if you took a piece of paper when you crumpled it up into a tiny ball, and then you opened it back up again, and it was filled with all these bends and folds and creases. You can think about all those creases and folds as all the latent tendencies and traits that have been forming in your consciousness for thousands and millions of lifetimes. And through the art of meditation, you can go about returning that piece of paper, which represents your consciousness, back to its original form of purity. And so, you know, I think any organization that pitches meditation will, you know, talk about stress relief and lowering blood pressure and things that people can sort of relate with. But at the end of the day, it's very much a purification process. And it really can solve just about any psychological issue people have. It's really getting in touch with your source. So it's my, you know, I'm just on a mission to get as many people to meditate as I can.
That's a good mission. Definitely a good mission. So hopefully you'll be doing your third film, Beyond Reason. Have you started a little bit of it, or are you just waiting to when you can travel? Because what Frank needs is he needs enough people to donate just a little bit of money so that he can afford to go make his third film. The first two films he's put out for free. They're there. Go watch them. Totally free. But the third film requires a little bit of travel. That's all.
Right. You know, it's funny. I've started working. A week before Beyond Belief was released, I didn't even have a film. You know, I had a bunch of clips that I had been... It took me a few months to record the individual sequences that were filmed out in nature, me interpreting, you know, the Gospel of Thomas, different sayings. It took me a long time to figure out how to weave the story. It wasn't as easy as it appears. Because I kind of had it sort of, you know, I had a lot of the historical evidence that I kind of wanted to do, and I knew that I was going to use Dale Martin's, he's a professor from Yale, I was going to use his material as a centerpiece, but I had no idea how I was going to, you know, link it all together, and that, you know, that somehow happened. But a week before I released it, I didn't have a film at all, and I just kind of cranked it out in a week. And Beyond Reason will probably be the same thing. I kind of know what I want to say, which is basically that our intellects are constrained primarily by our peripheral input devices, as they say in computers, our sensory input, our five senses, taste, touch, smell, sound, touch. And those really restrict our intellects. And so our intellects can really only get us so far. You can sit there and read all the Bibles and Vedantas and become a researcher and do all the studying you want, but you're never really going to get there. In other words, understanding universal truth. That's something that you can only know experientially. And so, you know, what I run into a lot, and maybe you've run into it as well, is when you're talking to people about any of this stuff, really. I'm not too interested in the free energy movement and all that. It's like, yeah, whatever. You know, hopefully we'll get that. That's more of a planetary issue that'll get resolved someday. UFOs and all that, I don't really care too much about it. It's just, how do you get more people to meditate? I've heard that if we can get the square root of 1% of the population on the planet, and I don't know what that number is. What's the square root of 600 million people? I don't know. Yeah, punch that into your calculator real quick. Whenever we get that number of people meditating regularly, that'll solve the planet's problems. That'll, you know, if you look at the turbulence in everybody's minds as like a very turbulent ocean during a maelstrom or, a big storm, if you just have... that number of people meditating, that'll calm all the minds on the planet, and then we can move forward as a species.
Well, this sort of thing has been proven over and over. The meditation, they've done tests where they've had events where large amounts of people would meditate, and the crime in that city would statistically go down. Art Bell did, and I've mentioned this several times on the show now, and I'll keep mentioning it. Art Bell did a thing where he did directed intention, where people, the first time, they affected a storm, and it freaked them out. And, you know, Art Bell had 22 million, 26 million listeners at the time. It affected a storm. Now, it freaked him out so much that he just said he would never do it again, because he basically thought no one man should have that much power, or no one man directing any amount of people should have that much power. And it just scared the bejesus out of him, so he decided not to do it again until Hoagland's health went down, and then he decided to do it again, and Hoagland was healed. I don't know of any other instances after that that he did it, because he thought it was playing with fire. But
right. Well, I know when Whitley Strieber's wife had a stroke or something, if I remember, they did the same thing, and she had like this miraculous recovery like the next day.
Right. So there's been multiple examples of this working, when people have they can direct their thoughts, and you can connect this to the 100th monkey syndrome. You got monkeys on one island that are washing their potatoes in the water, and then monkeys on a completely different island, you know, start instinctively doing it. It's we're all connected. I think even science has gotten to the point where physics has gotten to the point where they will admit that universally we're all connected, that we're all made up of the same basic stuff, and all that basic stuff is communicating. Spooky action at a distance, right?
Correct.
There you go. So we're all connected. And this sort of stuff is coming out now. And if you're right, if we can get more people meditating, it's certainly not going to hurt.
Yeah, but, you know, talking about spooky actions and, you know, entanglement theory and quantum physics, I'm not going to talk about any of that, or, you know, avoid that whole, you know, what the bleep do we know kind of quantum mechanics kind of angle with Beyond Reason. Because, you know, to me, it's enough of that. You know, these people who want things, that's what Beyond Reason means. Like, okay, Einstein can only get you so far, or his theories.
Right, right. So beyond the intellectual mapping of spirituality, let's get beyond reason.
Well, stop trying to understand the universe. Start meditating. Start understanding that, you know, this is the same things you're discovering in science, things that they knew 35,000 years ago. You know, that...
Yeah, the yogis saying to the science, the yogis saying to the scientists, it's about time you guys caught up.
Right. Right, exactly. And what are the yogis saying? They're not saying, let's go build, you know, all this stuff. They're saying, go meditate. You know, how many lifetimes do you want to be in this? You know, they can't, I mean, my brother's a professor at Stanford. They can't prove reincarnation. It's impossible to improve reincarnation, right? The
right.
Peer-reviewable, an article in the Science Review, whatever. There's nothing you can do to prove reincarnation. It's impossible. And yet without it, so many, you look at a movie like Beyond Me, the whole movie falls apart without reincarnation in it. And so much of what his work is, he's working on, and my brother's working on trying to solve epilepsy. And their solution is all about drugs and pharmacology and what kind of drugs can do this without even looking at consciousness. And, you know, I've talked to researchers in his lab, and they're all like, well, consciousness is a byproduct of brain function. Period. End of sentence. Because from their, you know, academic peer-reviewable perspective,
programmed, yeah.
Well, programmed, and you know, it's kind of weird talking to them because they just can't even go there. They can't even start thinking about something that's not been published.
I get it.
You know the drill. And,
no, I do. I mean, there's things you can point out, and they'll go, yeah, but that's not repeatable.
Right.
And, well, in a way, it is repeatable because I could give you multiple cases. Well, yes, but that's just multiple data points. That's not a repeatable single event, so I can't really go with that. And it's almost like...
Well, you got to be able to...
There's a barrier.
For it to be peer-reviewable, you have to be able to duplicate it. So data points, you know, you can duplicate data points, but not necessarily the same exact experiment. So you can't prove scientifically the existence of reincarnation. End of story. You can't really prove consciousness. you can prove things like entanglement theory, but who cares? That for them, that's still just science, and it's not spirituality.
Right. That they don't connect that necessarily to consciousness.
Exactly. And so Beyond Reason is really directed at the left-brained, person who's very much into the material world and not understanding that the material world is an illusion. And using logic, not Bibles, not books, not texts, and not science, but using logic to make a case for how that's actually the case.
Right.
I think I know exactly how I'm going to pull that off. It's going to be a phenomenal film, and if we're able to raise the $15,000, I have hopes that it can actually possibly be a theatrical release.
Then you'll be on a flight to India.
It'll be awesome.
Awesome.
I'm going to go to Europe. There's some people in Southern California I want to videotape. I'm in the Bay Area, so I would need to go down there. But I think it's like, look what I've done with zero money on my first two films. Give me $15K and I'll make a killer movie.
Yeah, you've done. Yeah, it is amazing. Absolutely, I give you props because you made two films with zero income and zero money and zero backing and zero help. So, and they're brilliant. Watch the films, guys. Seriously, they're brilliant films.
Beyond Me has been compared a lot to The Secret and What the Bleep Do We Know, and those have been both watched billions of times and made a lot of money. And that's pretty humbling. And the most humbling thing for me is a lot of the comments that I get. In fact, if you go to the Kickstarter page, there's one comment on there. Go ahead and click on that and read the comment. It's things like that just kind of blow me away.
Yeah, yeah. And think what you could do with an actual budget.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm very excited about it.
We've talked about a couple of subjects. Now, you mentioned something, Tom actually mentioned something, and we talked about this off the air. Frank showed me a film of something called Disc Hoops. And I want you to talk a little. I know we're going off in left field, but our listeners are used to me doing this to them, so it's okay. Disc Hoops. I want to know what Disc Hoops is.
I love to talk about Disc Hoops. Disc Hoops is my dance. I started playing Frisbee in the 60s, actually, with my father and my six brothers. We played Frisbee a lot. That was what we did. People out here in Pacific Ocean Park were skateboarding, and me and my brothers were playing Frisbee. And so in 1979 at Purdue, I started playing a game called Ultimate Frisbee, which, I was attracted to because I was an athlete and I played Frisbee. I had no idea what I was getting into. And unfortunately, Ultimate Frisbee, I can get myself into a lot of trouble here, but Ultimate Frisbee and Christianity have a lot of striking similarities, actually parallels. They're not even similarities. But Ultimate Frisbee is definitely a religion. In fact, they say that Abraham is the father of three religions, and that's not really true. He's the father of four. Ultimate Frisbee was one of the commonalities it has with Christianity is that it was created by Jewish people. And I won't get into the rest. I don't want to offend too many people. I just think it's an astounding coincidence. Nothing against Jews.
Okay.
Or anything like
so
that.
What was it you didn't like about Ultimate Frisbee? You got into it, and
there was a lot that I liked. I've played more Ultimate than probably anybody on the planet. I've probably played close to 5,000 times over the last 30 years. It's a highly addictive game. It's very fun. Don't get me wrong. There's a million people in this country who love it, and if you know any of them, they're different. They're very gung ho, and they're addicted. It's a serious addiction.
Don't worry. Quite a few of them are going to be emailing us tomorrow.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, yeah, half of them have already heard of me. I've been a very outspoken opponent because, imagine going to Vegas and winning the slot 60% of the time. Right? The house loses.
Right.
That's kind of what Ultimate is. There's no penalties. Imagine Kobe Bryant dribbling down the court being called for a traveling violation. And the referee whistling him and then giving him the ball back for a do-over. That's ultimate frisbee at the world championship level. And worse than that, not only is there, are there no penalties, but there's no referees. The players themselves call the calls against each other. And so that's basically your beach with bikini-clad women and margaritas. There's just no evolution in that kind of environment. And so I spent, you know, decades being a heretic, you know, inventing new offenses, new throws, new, you know, whole new styles of play that sort of, you know, I studied the rules and figured out, okay, you know, here's the boundary of what this, you know, here's the letter of the law, and I'm going to go up against that letter and push the envelope. And, you know, ultimate is a sport that has not evolved over 35 years. And not really. I mean, the players that play it now are not dope-smoking hippies like they used to be. They're fairly good-looking, athletic jocks, but they're still playing the same offenses, and there's no fans. We'll have a tournament here with the top teams in the country in Santa Cruz, you know, basically the top 10 or 15 teams in the world. Mm-hmm. And we have, in the Bay Area, apparently have 2,500, 3,000 Ultimate Frisbee fanatics. And other than the ones playing in the tournament, which would only be a few, really, because most of the other teams would come from around the country, nobody goes to watch. I mean, not a single person would go down to be a spectator. And so there's a variety of reasons for this. Like I said, the sport was invented. The guy who created it, Joel Silver, who's a huge Hollywood producer, he created the Matrix trilogy, Lethal Weapon trilogy, a whole bunch of stuff. You can Google Joel, Google image him, and you'll see he's not an athlete. And Ultimate Frisbee was made for basically the people who wouldn't even think about trying out for the third string football team. It was definitely a sport designed for the nerds. You know, and it was sort of like, you know, this is our sport. You guys can have all your others. And so there's a lot built into the consciousness. And you look at Beyond Me and my films and consciousness and how it works. There's a lot into the whole culture of, and a lot of belief systems, just like Christianity. There's dogma built into the rules of Ultimate. Thou shalt believe. This is this mm-hmm. because of this. With that, you know, without the rules ever having been thought through. And I've been miserable for a long time playing Ultimate. I'm the best in the world at what I do. That said, I'm probably the only person who does what I do because my style is so much different from everybody else. Right. And I shouldn't be the best of the world at what I do. You know, I'm an old guy and blah, blah, blah. That, you know, people should have figured this out by now, but they haven't. So I went off and created Disc Hoops, which is... Disc Hoops, D-I-S-C-H-O-O-P-S, discoops.com. I think there's probably a link to it in beyondmefilm.com as well.
I'll put a link to Disc Hoops. We're talking about it. I'm going to put a link to discoops.com. I want people to watch. There's a couple of videos I'm going to link to as well. Frank does this. I don't know how many throws you did with the Frisbee in this one demonstration. That's one video I'm going to link to. And the second one, was it like 60 different throws you did?
It's I don't know in that video because there's a lot of throws I intentionally didn't put in that video.
Well, it was a ridiculous amount of throws. That's what it was.
I've had a ridiculous amount of spare time on my hands.
and then the second video I'm going to put is an example of disc soups. So I want to know the rules and how many people on team and what can you do and what can't you do and how have you changed it. Well, how is this a reimagining of the game?
Oh, it's not. It's a significantly different game. There's very little left from Ultimate at all. It's played on a really small field, actually, and it conveniently fits inside of your local arena. We can put it in the HP arena here. It would fit on something that would be like an arena football field. It's got two arches that are 20 yards apart, and you score through that sort of like through, you would think, through a lacrosse field, except there's a small end zone that your receiver has to catch it in on the other side of that. And then as soon as you catch a score, similar to how in basketball or football the field reverses at halftime, in disc hoops the field reverses every time someone scores. So it's an incredibly fast-paced game, extremely high octane, extremely entertaining. I've played everything from hockey to soccer to ultimate, and this is by far the most the most you know, exhausting. It's the most fun. It's really and it's the most fun to watch sport that I've ever seen.
How long is the break between the quarters?
There's a 2-minute break between quarters, 10-minute halftime. There's 4 15-minute quarters. So this, you know, excuse my language, but this game is a real ball breaker. It's played 4-on-4, and there's 8 people per team. So you've got 4 people to substitute in during the game. There's a couple of timeouts per halftime. Those are 1 minute long. And there's stoppages for play for penalties and stuff. But it's exhausting. Basically, you get to the point sometimes where you have to foul intentionally just so that you can get out of the game.
So you have to be in an incredible shape to play.
This is not for the faint of heart, for sure. Although, if you're playing with a group of friends, whatever the level that they're playing at, I'm sure you'll do fine. You'll just, as a group, you'll agree to take a lot of breaks. It's very cardiovascular. Most sports, even though you think of the ones that are high octane, there's room for some downtime. And if you're playing soccer, you know, you could be on one end of the field and the action's going on the other, and you can get some rest. You know, ultimately, you can definitely get some rest or other sports like that. But there's no downtime in disc hoops, otherwise you're getting scored on and your team is compromised. So you have to be in top shape.
Is it being played comparatively right now?
It's not. If we play it in the Bay Area here, we've been playing it for about 5 years. There's a link on the site for disc hoops with testimonials from around the country where people have played it. But, you know, I'm running into a situation, like I said, of highly addicted people and ultimate frisbee players. Except they don't really understand that they're addicted to methadone. And, you know, disc scoops is the real shit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
But they're addicted. They're so addicted to ultimate that they just, I mean, some of these guys that I know out here, they're world champion ultimate players, and they're gorgeous when they play disc scoops. I mean, from a perspective of someone who's a technician and, you know, looking at how people are moving and, you know, that we, just the real nuances of how they're throwing, what they're throwing, how they're pivoting and all those kinds of things. They are, you know, it's just perfect. And yet I watch them go play ultimate and they're horrible. All their techniques are wrong. Their fundamentals are wrong. I mean, this is according to me, but still, it's just like hideous to watch these guys and they don't know it. It's just like a bunch of people who've just been brainwashed. They've drank in the Kool-Aid, and they go play ultimate. So for me to get the sport off the ground, you know, I actually made an entry into Kickstarter when I did the one for Beyond Reason for disc hoops, and they turned it down. They didn't think it was a good idea. It didn't fit within their... But, yeah, disc hoops would need some sort of backing, I think, to get people... I need some... what do they have for those cults for people to get them deprogrammed?
Oh, yeah, deprogramming. They need deprogramming sessions.
Yeah, ultimate players need a lot of deprogramming. And, you know, I was one of them. You know, I'm a recovering ultimate player.
Yeah. Hi.
Yeah.
My name's Frank Huguenard, and I'm a recovering ultimate player. I'm now going to India.
Yeah. Like I said, ultimate was a lot of fun, but competitive ultimate was not. You'd go into tournaments, and it's such, you know, bizarre. It would have been like, you know, Christianity in the first or second century, where it's like everybody's got their own version of the rules. So you've got your team, and you go and you play, and everyone's like, "What? That's you know, that's not traveling. What?" You know, and you just argue, and people win by, you know, by arguing rather than through their skills. It's just a horribly uneven playing field. And ultimate players say, "Well, what are you talking about, Frank? We're all playing by the same set of rules." And I think, well, whatever.
Maybe that's the problem.
It's a set of rules that was designed for the lowest common denominator.
Right. Maybe. Yeah. So, like,
so it was designed specifically. The people who made up the rules hate Frank. Now, they never met him, but I epitomize that person that they hate, that competitive jock who, you know, whatever I do, I'm really good at. Whether, you know, whether it's playing, throwing a frisbee or making documentary films, you know, or making pizza. And
ooh, you make good pizza too?
Dude, you didn't read about my pizza restaurant? I had this Indian pizza restaurant that was just phenomenal.
Indian?
Yeah, I took, we had this, we didn't have a menu. Have you ever had dim sum?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we served the pizza dim sum style, but we didn't charge. We just had an all-you-can-eat price for, you know, I think $12.99. And we had all these different toppings, so maybe 40 different toppings on every given night. Each topping had a slightly different Indian flavoring on it. And then we had like 10 different sauces. And so you would sit at your table, and the cart would come around. You would grab another slice. Every slice would be different. Every pizza would be different. Basically, every night people came in and told me it was the best pizza they'd have in their lives.
You know, I've never heard of Indian pizza, but I think I'm going to have to open one up here.
This is the
first one that I've ever heard.
We were profitable after 4 weeks, which is impossible in the restaurant industry, as you well know.
Well, considering how many Indians I have in my area here,
I think I
can make a killing.
This is a, that was the beauty of it. This was a really great crossover for people who either weren't too psyched up about Indian foods, but we had a huge, diverse crowd come in just because the food was so phenomenal. That's,
you know what is interesting is exactly what you just said there, is people that would be nervous about having Indian food for the first time, or
they've had it and they've just had curries and you know and just didn't understand what the food is. And that India is like this gigantic continent with, you know, 1.2 billion people, and there's actually North Indian, South Indian, and all these different things, and they just see Indian food as one thing,
right? Which is why you can have so many ingredients and so many sauces and so many, right?
Right, exactly. And so, anyway, back to Ultimate, I'm the person that the people who created the game hated. I was the high school quarterback. I mean, I wasn't really the high school quarterback, but I'm that guy. And so you've got this whole culture who from the get-go has that kind of anti-Frank mentality. And it was, you know, it's very difficult to go and compete in that. So I tried competing for decades and was pretty miserable. I'm just a very unhappy person because, you know, you're trying to win in a system that can't be won.
It can't be won.
So like Kirk in the in Star Trek, he rewrote the rules.
Right.
Kobayashi Maru.
Yep.
I rewrote the rules like Kirk did.
Okay, so
that's what Disc Hoops is, and Disc Hoops is the greatest sport ever invented.
Now, have you been putting it out there? I mean, do you get local games going? Get a small group of people that have gotten onto it?
Yeah, and it's been tough. You know, I haven't been shy with my attitude towards Ultimate Frisbee, and so I'm literally a heretic. And, you know, I'm someone who's just been railing against their belief systems. And so, you know, I've got this reputation and, you know, people are like, well, you know, what are you doing that? You know, it's really a religious thing. And so it's been a struggle and I really would like to get the sport backed.
So there's some people coming with a cross for you.
I've got so many daggers in my back. It's not funny.
how long has it been since you came up with the... you know, the rules and all the setup?
Late 2005 is when I came up with the game. And I would say I pretty much hit the nail on the head. In other words, of the rules that I originally penned down 6 years ago now, almost 6 years ago, 95% of them are still there. You know, we started playing it, and of course, once you started playing it, you know, you realize, okay, this needs to be tweaked. But for the most part, I hit the nail on the head. And, you know, I got to tell you, it's the most incredible thing. I'm experiencing something that nobody's really experienced since 1895, when Dr. Nesmith invented basketball. I mean, you don't have a lot of people inventing team sports and then going out and having people actually play the sport and then watching them do things. You know, I've given them this framework and said, okay, here's the rules. Go have fun, and then watch people do things that are beyond my wildest dreams. Oh, wow, did you see that? Did he really just do that, you know?
Had some positive feedback from the people who have actually played the game?
Sure, there's a testimonial page on the website.
Okay.
You know, like I said, people love the sport. They're just addicted to Ultimate, and my association with being a heretic and being like this, you know, whatever.
Well, you're speaking against the system.
Right.
When you were playing Ultimate,
yeah.
At what level did you play?
At what level? I play at the highest level.
So the professional level?
There is no professional level. Like I said, there will be a tournament in Santa Cruz with the top 15 teams in the world, and nobody will watch them. There's no money involved.
Yeah, there's no money involved.
Look, let's put it this way. There was 2 years ago, I was voted onto the North American All-Star team, and we played against the world champions. And I was a little bit hamstrung by the fact that they shackled me with a coach who didn't understand my strategy and, you know, really didn't give us the opportunity to have me work with them and say, okay, here's how I play, you know, here's how it's going to be. You know, I'm the best player on the field, and I need you guys to support me this way. They were sort of did everything they could to prevent that from happening. And there were more people watching that game than I've ever seen. Most of them were there to watch me. There was probably 2,500 people around the field. And I dominated. A 48-year-old guy, out of shape, torn meniscus in my knee, and I was the best player on the field. And everybody pretty much knew it by the end of the game. It was phenomenal. It was a lot of fun.
And did it take off from? I mean, did anything change after that? Or
no, that was the sad thing. There was a guy who makes a living filming Ultimate Frisbee. I can't imagine he makes a lot of money, but he sells within the community. I don't think he makes much money at all. But he had traveled there just to videotape me fall on my face because I had been talking all the smack. And I thought, okay, this is it, right? Because everyone, like I said, they thought I was one of two things, either this delusional fool or this bitter old man, but someone who didn't know how to play. And then I'd been talking all the smack, and I thought, okay, you know, I've proved it. You know, I had their best player come up to me after the game and said, dude, you embarrassed us. And I thought, okay, now all that stuff that I said, and there was a lot of knowledge about the game, you know, here's how you should play, here's how you should pivot. Now the game's going to change because I've gotten the legitimacy that I've been searching for all these years. And the guy who videotaped it didn't post the video, and nothing really changed.
Did not post the video?
Of course not. He only wanted to post a video of me looking like a fool. He didn't get any footage of that.
See, now that's, and I take it after that, you didn't go back.
Well, you know, I've been kicked out of about every game in the Bay Area. I just got kicked out of my last game about 3 weeks ago. You know, I go in, and it's such a screwed up system. I mean, if you walked onto a basketball court, and every time you caught the ball, just launched it from midcourt, well, what would happen to you?
Well, one of two things. One, if you're very good and put the hoop in every single time, then you'd be a god. Two, if you did it and missed every single time, you'd be a guy who shouldn't be on the floor in the first place.
And so what would happen? You either wouldn't get the ball anymore, or you would get yelled at.
Oh, you mean other players? Yeah, you'd never get the ball.
You'd never get the ball, and you would just be belittled, and you know, you would get all kinds of stuff. Ultimate's got something built into it that prevents that from happening. And I get just young punks coming up to me, and they don't know anything. they're yelling at me, and they just think that everybody should be on equal footing. And it's like, wait a second. You know, where else in the world, anywhere, sports or otherwise, do you give equal respect to the, you know, third round draft pick as you do to the, you know, the best player on the field? It doesn't work that way. But in ultimate, that's built into the rules. And so I tend to get kicked out of a lot of games.
Okay. Well, we've covered Disc Hoops. We've covered the both of the films, and you're going to be making a third film, Beyond Reason, the documentary film. I would like to read that quote that you got on your website talking about the film. Somebody watched your film and they left a quote. I'm going to just read that because I did just read it and I thought it was awesome. The quote is, "If your mind is open enough to have found its way to this site, then your mind is going to love Frank's films. He doesn't crack our faith in humanity, he expands it. I've been able to put to immediate use some of the ancient new facts he presents. Fact is, we need this third film. Please help." There you go.
How humbling is that?
Yeah, well, it's nice to get a good feedback on your films. And hopefully now that, you know, you're doing some interviews, and you're going to be doing more interviews, I hope, to spread the knowledge of these films, because definitely it needs to get out there. I highly recommend both these films. You got to watch them, guys. Seriously, it's good information, and he's going to be going to India to back up some of the stuff in one of his films and get some more knowledge. And you're generally going to go more on to the, you're going to talk to some gurus and teachers that are in the East, right?
Yeah, some of the most advanced, minds on consciousness on the planet. And they've got, Carl Jung went to India, I think 100 years ago, around this time, in 1910 or so. And, you know, he discovered that they, you know, compared to Western psychology, they had a, you know, he was humbled that they had this 5,000-year head start on them. And it's kind of funny how, you know, in the West here, I'll hear psychologists start to say, well, you know, we're starting to use some of their stuff from the East. And I'm like, God, how arrogant is that? You know, you're starting to use some of their stuff. I got an idea. Why don't you just use all their stuff?
Yeah.
And throw your books away. I'm going to meet with as many, like I said, rishis and swamis, yogis as I can to really elicit exactly the specific knowledge I'm looking for that'll make the case that I'm making. And I did want to add, for people that that do want to learn to meditate, there's a lot of good cases in Beyond Me for why you should and why your arguments of why you shouldn't aren't very good arguments. Like I said, if you knew what you were missing, you would do it daily. And the important thing is to do it every day for 5 minutes. There's no excuse not to, just to sit quietly. Follow your breath or something. But if you really are serious about it, I would recommend taking a class. And the class that I would recommend can be found at artofmeditation.com. You can throw that link up there if you want to. There's a few other organizations. There's TM, of course. I think their meditation class costs about $2,500. It isn't as good through the way I look at it.
Yeah, there's also the Silva method.
There's Silva, there's Vipassana, which is actually, you can go for free, it's donation-based. I did the Vipassana 10-day class, and it is serious boot camp for meditation. If you really want an intense class, go for it. It'll kick your butt. It's basically 11 hours of meditation a day for 10 days with no talking, and you just sit. Get up, stretch your legs, sit again. That's pretty intense, too. But my preference or my recommendation would be artofmeditation.com.
Okay, that's good. I will definitely put those links up as well. Just send me an email with a lot of some of these links we're talking about in case I forget.
Sure.
So I make sure I get them up and on the site. And when you do make your film and come back from India and come back and get all the editing done, and when you put it out, I want you to promise to come back on and talk about your adventures and that's sort of the people you met and during the course of filming.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be, you know, just being completely untethered and just going from town to town and, you know, allowing, you know, the universe to sort of guide me. And, I think that's really when magic happens in your life, when you just, you know, you can move around freely and just assume you're being taken care of. And you just know, you know, whoever you sit next to on the airplane or whoever is on the bus with you or whoever it is not there by accident. And, you know, everybody's going to be there for some purpose. And it's a very fun thing to do.
If you do it as a synchronistic event, you would be surprised at the amazing things that can happen. Well, you've already had that sort of stuff happen in your life, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was just in Berlin 2 weeks ago, and, you know, just over one weekend, there were at least 12, you know, maybe 15 fairly major synchronous events. And that was just over 3 days.
Yeah.
So give me 3 or 4 months in, excuse me, in India, and it'll be phenomenal. And I'm sure the film will just be incredible.
I'm absolutely sure it will be. Okay, well, we got to wrap up. Thank you, Frank, for joining us on the show. Anybody wants to listen to this episode tomorrow, it'll be on the past guest page at www.spectrumradionetwork.com, and you can check it out there in the archives. We'll have links to a lot of the stuff Frank's been talking about. I think his is going to be a link-heavy past guest, but that's cool. Gives you lots of stuff to look into, and we'll catch you guys next week.
All right. Tom and Scott, thanks for so much for having me on.
It's been our pleasure.
It was awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.